Chapter 5. Get Rid of the List. April 3rd, 2018. Strapped into red webbed jump seats in the back of a hulking C-130 Hercules transport plane, Arnie and I lifted off from McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. Once at cruising altitude, we were invited to climb into the cockpit to say hello to the pilot. We discovered an airman who looked like he had just graduated from high school. "What's it like to fly up here?" Arnie asked him nervously, trying to feel him out. "I don't know," he said. "Never flown this route before." Arnie looked at me like he was going to pass out. A full year before the ACLU had accused the Trump administration of carrying out a national practice of separating parents and children at the border, then Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly justified a potential separation policy by saying he wanted to deter people from traveling on what he called an awful network, the dangerous journey from Central America through Mexico and to the United States. Then, and now, if you want to understand why a record number of Central Americans are migrating to the United States, the country of Greenland, of all places, is a great place to start. Aaron McGarry, the head of the NBC News weather unit, had lined up rare access with NASA to fly to Thule Air Base in Greenland, 750 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Once there, we'd hitch a ride on their P-3 Orion, a former spy plane, now being used for Operation Icebridge, a mission designed to buy scientists time as they put an advanced satellite into orbit that would measure land and sea ice levels at climate change's ground zero. Thule in the spring is lovely. The low temperature the day we landed was negative 15 degrees Fahrenheit, and the mercury spiked at 3 above zero. After we deplaned, we got a tour of the base, including the hangar that housed NASA's team, then drove down to the sea ice to go dog sledding with a local who has seen the climate changing in real time. First thing the following morning, I left Arnie and Aaron behind. There were only so many seats aboard Icebridge, and we took off for what was scheduled to be an all-day flight at the ridiculously low altitude of 1,500 feet. Our destination was Petermann Glacier. John Sontag, mission scientist and navigator of the trip, was able to break away from keeping us on track, and we talked about why Operation Icebridge and funding for it, at risk under President Trump, was so critical. "What you guys see up here every year is what climate change actually looks like," I said to him. "Yeah, this is kind of the front lines of climate change," Sontag replied. "That sea level rise here is what we all feel down at home." "Yeah, if you take away some of the sea ice, you make the whole planet darker and make it more able to absorb the sun's energy." When we were talking, I was thinking about sea level rise I had seen covering Hurricane Irma while in Miami. Only now can I make the connection to the dry corridor in Central America. Cutting through Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, it's a massive stretch of land in which its residents are suffering from severe malnutrition and poverty, exacerbated by a years-long drought due to the climate variability of El Niño. Rising temperatures are also fueling a rapidly spreading fungus affecting coffee leaves, the region's cash crop and livelihood for tens of thousands, at higher-than-ever altitudes, and in so doing, destroying lives. People in Central America were starving to death, in part because of warming here in the Arctic, and it was driving hundreds of thousands to flee to the United States, the same people President Trump was trying to stop from coming. Bouncing around violently through the turbulence as we traversed Petermann Glacier, I had no idea I was on the front lines of a crisis playing out over 4,000 miles away in Guatemala. This, however, was not where Donald Trump was looking for a solution. 3 days later, we flew home from Thule, this time on a military passenger jet carrying troops and their family members back to the States. The same day, President Trump issued a memorandum for a select group of his cabinet members, the Secretary of Defense, the Attorney General, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the Secretary of Homeland Security. The subject: ending catch and release at the border of the United States and directing other enhancements to immigration enforcement. President Trump was seeing the number of migrants illegally crossing the southern border steadily rise. After he was inaugurated, migrants were at first holding back because of Trump's tough talk, arriving in smaller numbers. Under 400,000 were taken into custody in Trump's first full year in office, as low as that number had been in decades. Though the numbers were still below those of the final year of the Obama administration, a graph showing an increase was posted regularly on the website of Customs and Border Protection. The Trump effect, as agents on the front lines called it, was wearing off. In March 2018, more than 50,000 migrants were detained trying to enter the United States illegally. The year before, the number had been only 16,794. Trump's memo had a deliverable. By mid-May, end the practice of releasing migrants apprehended at the border to the interior of the country while they wait for their immigration court case to be adjudicated. Within 45 days of the date of this memorandum, the Secretary of Homeland Security, in coordination with the Secretary of Defense, the Attorney General, and the Secretary of Health and Human Services, shall submit a report to the President detailing all measures that their respective departments have pursued or are pursuing to expeditiously end catch-and-release practices. 45 days. The clock was now ticking. One of the agencies directed by President Trump to end catch-and-release, the Department of Justice, got to work that same day. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in a message to all U.S. attorneys' offices on the southwest border, announced the implementation of a, quote, zero-tolerance prosecution policy for those stopped crossing the border illegally, including asylum seekers. During the Obama and Bush administrations, most migrants apprehended were charged with a civil offense and allowed to proceed with their immigration cases in immigration court. But the Trump administration wanted to change that, sending every migrant caught into the federal court system to stand against criminal charges. The implementation of the Attorney General's zero-tolerance policy comes as the Department of Homeland Security reported a 203% increase in illegal border crossings from March 2017 to March 2018, a press release announcing the plan declared, ignoring the fact those were still near-record-low numbers, continuing, quote, a 37% increase from February 2018 to March 2018. The largest month-to-month increase since 2011. The practical impact of Sessions' direction, as members of the Obama administration had debated and discovered but never implemented, would be profound. If you were a parent traveling with your child and charged under the zero-tolerance plan, that meant you'd be separated from your child in order to be charged in criminal court. Your child would be referred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, having been rendered unaccompanied. To those who wish to challenge the Trump administration's commitment to public safety, national security, and the rule of law, I warn you, Sessions said in a statement. Illegally entering this country will not be rewarded, but will instead be met with the full prosecutorial powers of the Department of Justice. To the department's prosecutors, I urge you, promoting and enforcing the rule of law is vital to protecting a nation, its borders, and its citizens. You play a critical part in fulfilling these goals, and I thank you for your continued efforts in seeing to it that our laws, and as a result, our nation, are respected. Kevin McAleenan, President Trump's Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, who had been confirmed by the Senate in March, also received Trump's memo. McAleenan, too, wanted to end catch and release, and had been involved in some of the Trump administration's earliest conversations about family separations. But he also believed that one potential way to stop catch and release was to address the push factors fueling migration in the first place, including a changing climate. As I flew home from Greenland, aid flowing from Washington to Central America to alleviate and mitigate the effects of the climate-caused drought and food insecurity was working. The United States Agency for International Development was funding a variety of programs that targeted communities in which extreme poverty and malnutrition were pushing residents to leave for the United States, the best option left to help their families. Guatemalans were heading north by the tens of thousands, most from regions affected by drought or climate change from the country's western highlands to the arid center of the country. In the north of Guatemala, the department of Petén, where Juan and José lived, was also feeling the effects of a changing climate. 4 million hectares of subtropical forest are found in Guatemala, 70% of which are located within natural protected areas, like the Maya Biosphere Reserve in the department of Petén, USAID reported in an analysis of Guatemala's environment. Guatemala is one of the most vulnerable countries to the impacts of climate change, which disproportionately affect rural indigenous farmers and exacerbate poor land management practices. That instability caused by climate change was creating an opening for drug cartels moving narcotics from South and Central America through Mexico and into the United States, with many farmers in the region finding the drug trade more lucrative than their work in unreliable fields. President Trump, however, was no fan of foreign aid, even if it kept farmers afloat and potential migrants at home. He still felt the same way after evidence was presented to his administration later in 2018 by Customs and Border Protection, which showed climate change and variability were fueling the food insecurity driving migration. The administration ultimately ignored the consequences of climate change, which candidate Trump had called a Chinese hoax, when in 2019 it defunded programs to mitigate its effects, instead choosing to continue punishing migrants when they made it to the United States, in lieu of helping them at home. But punishing migrants was a strategy that was already well underway by the time Juan and José were faced with a life-changing decision. The 15th day of April in Petén, Guatemala, Juan's brother received a phone call. The farm worker picked up his cell and an unknown voice asked to speak with Juan urgently. He raced to his brother's home, the one up the hill from the soccer field. When he arrived, another call came through from the same man. Juan took the phone. "Something's wrong," Juan told his brother after hanging up. He was shaken by what he had heard. Juan's nephew had sold a car that was still legally registered in Juan's name. The new owner, who Juan believed to be a member of a drug cartel, wanted him to sign paperwork turning over ownership of the car, something Juan did not think he had the right to do. If he didn't, the man threatened, he would be killed, and he feared so would his son, José. Juan, a devout evangelical Christian, was terrified. He thought of his family, Maria and their two girls. He knew what could happen if he tried to push back. Any dispute with someone threatening his life was not one he wanted to have. In a place where narco violence was commonplace and murders were not unusual, he felt as though he faced certain death. Juan, who had twice before made the journey to the United States, believed doing it again, this time with his son, was his only way to survive. His wife and daughters, also in danger, would seek shelter outside of his home. And he told his brother that in the face of the threat he had just received, he felt he needed to leave the country as soon as possible. He would start planning the journey immediately. April 18th, 2018. Threat was how Commander Jonathan White, in drafting a memo for Scott Lloyd, the Trump-appointed head of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and the man with legal custody of thousands of migrant children, characterized the specter of wide-scale family separations in the fall of 2017. Commander White had worked for Lloyd until March, when he sought out another role within HHS outside of ORR in protest of Lloyd's attempts to stop all female unaccompanied minors from having abortions. It was a blow for the department. Commander White and his years of institutional knowledge about caring for migrant children would take a post within the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, the arm of Health and Human Services that responds to natural disasters and outbreaks. The following month, Caitlin Dickerson, the award-winning New York Times immigration reporter, was digging into family separations. She had obtained data showing family separations were no longer an initiative isolated to certain parts of the border, but a widespread practice, just as the ACLU had alleged in federal court. Less than 2 weeks after President Trump issued his memorandum to end catch and release, Dickerson had in hand documents that showed far more migrant children were separated from their parents in government custody than had previously been reported. And after presenting the Trump administration with what she knew, she was waiting for answers. "Hi," wrote Dickerson on a Wednesday afternoon to officials at the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal entity ORR is a part of. "We've passed my deadline. Where are we on a response to these questions?" 2 days before Dickerson, on the verge of breaking her story, sent the email to HHS, I was on the Arizona border shooting our Dateline NBC special near the small town of Aravaca. It was there I had my second visit with rancher Tom Kay, a cowboy pushing 80 years old who, this time, to stay comfortable, wore white sneakers with his white cowboy hat instead of boots. My last trip here, I picked up a pistol off his dashboard to ask him what it was for. "It's just safety," he told me as we drove in his pickup truck not far from his ranch, where on his own personal stretch of border, he claimed to have once seen a migrant crossing through it with an AK-47. "We don't know who's stopped on the road here." The following day, I met some of those who might soon be traveling through Tom Kay's land, and they didn't have an AK-47. After crossing the border into Nogales, Sonora, from Nogales, Arizona, the Dateline crew and I met a family from Nicaragua at the Juan Bosco Migrant Shelter, set on a hillside overlooking a train station and the city below. They explained to me they were getting ready to cross the border. "Everyone wants to come to the U.S.?" I asked the mother of the family inside the church attached to the shelter, a small white building topped with a solitary cross. "All of us," she told me. "We have problems in Nicaragua, and we cannot go back. We're afraid to go back to Nicaragua. They threatened him," she told me, referring to her husband who was sitting with her children, including a curly-haired toddler who reminded me of my boy. "We work on a farm, and the owner of the farm was killed. And then they came to where we were." "You came to Nogales because you want to cross into the United States. How are you going to cross? Are you going to ask for asylum? Are you going to go into the desert?" "We're going to ask for asylum," she told me. "What if they say no?" I asked. "I don't know what we're going to do because it's our hope. Because we can't return to Nicaragua. And here, neither, because here they can kill us too," she said of Nogales. She was right. Some on our team who knew the city well said that directly above the shelter, they believed we were being watched by cartel members. "If they say no to you at the checkpoint," I wondered, "do you think you would try to cross in the desert?" The father chimed in. "If there isn't another option, maybe." What Caitlin Dickerson knew, but I didn't, was that where they crossed wouldn't matter. The threat they faced either at the Nogales port of entry or the desert around it was the same. They could be separated just like the U.S. government was beginning to do to hundreds of other families. Dickerson was still pressing the federal government to confirm her reporting. The details she sent them would send the organization into crisis mode. "We are preparing to publish a story based on ORR data provided to us by Homeland Security officials on background that shows more than 700 children have been separated from their parents since last October. According to our sources, the data shows that about half of the children are under 10 years old, and more than a quarter are under 5 years old. The story will also say that ORR contracted shelters have struggled increasingly to track down the parents of children who show up at their facilities after being separated. So the children effectively become lost in the system until ORR contractors can track the parents down. We wanted to run this by you to ensure that HHS/ORR doesn't dispute any of our findings or care to add context or further comment." Dickerson had a major scoop on her hands. But curiously, not everyone inside HHS was so sure. In a sign of the extraordinary confusion surrounding family separations that would follow, not everyone could say if what the New York Times was poised to report was actually happening. A public affairs specialist at the Administration for Children and Families, the part of HHS that encompasses ORR, finally emailed Dickerson back on Thursday, more than a full day past her deadline, to tell her that they, quote, cannot verify the numbers because they do not come from the Office of Refugee Resettlement. The numbers do, in fact, come from HHS/ORR, Dickerson replied. The specialist now wasn't positive, emailing three other ACF employees for guidance within 20 minutes. Can ORR provide any insight as to where she may have gotten the data or why she would be so insistent the data is from ORR? By this time, the workday was ending, but the FLAC realized there was a public relations crisis brewing. I will be staying after hours until approximately 6:45 p.m. and look forward to hearing back from you on a proposed response. Please ensure that Scott has approved any response we will provide, he wrote, referring to Scott Lloyd, ORR's director. Please let me know if you have any questions. Happy to discuss by phone or come upstairs in person. Am here to assist in this as needed. 23 minutes later, a reply came through from one of those colleagues, clarifying the source of the data Dickerson had in hand, and suggesting a proposed response. Sounds like DHS shared some ORR data that does not represent the full picture of DHS actions. It also sounds like a symptom of breakdown in interagency communications. You could develop something like this, although I don't know if it will clear. The Department of Homeland Security does not inform the Office of Refugee Resettlement that a particular referred child was separated or the whereabouts of parents. In pursuing the best interests of the child, ORR and its service providers worked diligently to identify if each child was separated and to locate the parents. While ORR does not receive information or data on DHS actions, ORR has worked to resolve several hundred of these types of cases in the past year. Within 3 minutes, two other ACF officials were looped in on the email, and 7 minutes after that, Trump appointee Lloyd was added too. He had already been made aware of the New York Times request. The confusion among colleagues in the agency caring for allegedly separated children was evident in the questions posed by one employee. What is unclear to me is, if DHS does not share family separation UAC data with ORR, then where would any such data come from? In other words, is ORR building its own data set based on what we learn upon searching for a parent? The answer was yes. The ORR data set, or informal list of separated minors in the custody of the department, was being kept by Jim De La Cruz, the senior field specialist who had first noticed a similar practice during the Obama administration in 2016. At the time, case managers at government shelters throughout the country were reporting a small number of children saying they had been taken from their parents, despite senior members of the Obama administration opposing the practice, as had De La Cruz, in emails to colleagues. The numbers they were now seeing were far beyond anything during the Obama administration. 10 minutes later, the proposed response was sent back to the group based on input from the Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs. It added a line at the top about how ORR, quote, cannot and will not corroborate a data report we have not seen from an unknown source. If released, the statement would be an admission that family separations were increasing in the Trump era. 10 more minutes passed, and at exactly 6 in the evening, a career ORR employee weighed in to confirm that indeed the data supported it was happening. For your background, I think the DHS shared with the press the number from the working list that our field recently compiled and shared with DHS Field, a working field document to try to get a handle on this problem, not an official count. It is likely not a complete or accurate list/number. It grew to over 700, so the actual number of separations is probably larger. The New York Times was right. More than 700 separated children. Within 3 minutes, the ORR staffer's boss, Scott Lloyd, wrote back with questions of his own. How do we know that they were separations? Is it through the reunification process? Do we know whether these cases represent a rise in the percentage of UAC in care? The numbers of referrals generally have been rising. Lloyd was asking not only how his agency becomes aware of separations, but if the percentage of separated children in his custody was increasing relative to the overall population. Nearly instantly, he received a reply. Yes, it may become known through the ordinary course of work in ORR. Then ORR reaches out to DHS to try to find the parents and establish communication. As to your second question, it looks like the field found around 100 a month. Yes, it is an increase. Before 2017, family separation happened, but not often. Within minutes, it became clear to a communications official on the email chain what was happening. ORR was denying something that was true. The more than 700 separations was their number, and the practice was happening on an unprecedented scale, far beyond anything in the previous administration, when Jim De La Cruz had started tracking the numbers. Okay, so we have a problem here when we told the New York Times today, quote, "We cannot verify the numbers because they do not come from the Office of Refugee Resettlement at HHS's Administration for Children and Families." ORR field staff numbers are ORR numbers on UACs, even if they aren't in the form of an official report, especially when they are shared with DHS. ORR, would you propose revised language, including numbers/data, based on what we now know? We need to amend our New York Times statement ASAP. Less than 2 hours after Caitlin Dickerson showed her cards, sending ACF and ORR officials scrambling before the Times published, everyone finally seemed to be on the same page. The career ORR employee replied with a final suggestion at 6:31 in the evening, encouraging more specificity than the proposed statement circulated earlier. From a programmatic perspective, since DHS is now using ORR working data to describe their actions, I don't have a problem with using the last two paragraphs below, or even more specifically saying that the number exceeded 700 instead of, quote, several hundred. 14 minutes before the public affairs specialist who fielded Dickerson's request had hoped to head home for the night, there finally seemed to be agreement on the number of separated children in the custody of ORR. But inside the tiny department tasked with caring for thousands of migrant children crossing the border, its Trump-appointed leader still wanted more details. I'd be interested to know the story of this communication with DHS. Scott Lloyd wrote back only to the email's author at 6:45, who waited until late that night after 11 in the evening to reply. The explanation was that the DHS information technology infrastructure didn't share the key detail of whether a child had been separated between relevant agencies, including ORR, resulting in confusion about the number of family separations, making reunifications difficult, if not impossible. This described the exact scenario that had been raised previously by officials, including ICE's Claire Trickler McNulty, who was actively trying to fix it. But separations proceeded nevertheless. The communication with DHS goes back a long while. ORR and DHS tried to figure out a solution to the lack of notice and coordination. DHS realized about 2 months ago that they had an internal glitch in causing the problem of lack of notice. That was during an OGC OPLA call. DHS and ORR are never supposed to communicate each other's data. Each are supposed to refer to the respective comms team. So I am surprised that DHS shared ORR field info with the press as a representation of their own enforcement actions. Also, it almost looks like the reporter is talking to staff or grantees, or maybe with DHS staff. Let me see what I can find out. On Friday, June 20th, the Times article went live. "Hundreds of immigrant children have been taken from parents at U.S. border," the headline read. In the article, HHS confirmed Dickerson's numbers were correct. Whether or not the journalist was aware of the internal debate that led to the admission HHS made, she detailed how difficult it was to receive confirmation. "Officials have repeatedly declined to provide data on how many families have been separated, but suggested that the number was relatively low. But new data reviewed by the New York Times shows that more than 700 children have been taken from adults claiming to be their parents since October, including more than 100 children under the age of 4. The data was prepared by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, a division of the Department of Health and Human Services that takes custody of children who have been removed from migrant parents. Senior officials at the Department of Homeland Security, which processes migrants at the border, initially denied that the numbers were so high. But after they were confirmed to the Times by three federal officials who work closely with these cases, a spokesman for the Health and Human Services Department on Friday acknowledged in a statement that there were, quote, approximately 700. This admission that the federal government was systematically separating families was the exact type of action Senator Kamala Harris had asked Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen about during Nielsen's confirmation process. In response to a question specifically requesting Nielsen report back on whether DHS was drafting or considering separations, Nielsen replied, "I commit to sharing additional policy guidance and appropriate information with Congress." But she never did. Harris and others, including myself, would get confirmation the policy was being carried out, first in the Houston Chronicle, and now in the New York Times. As the director of the office keeping the leaked list of 700 separated children now publicly contradicting the Trump administration's denial of a family separation policy, Scott Lloyd was pissed off. He wasn't the only one. Inside the White House's Eisenhower Executive Office Building on the Friday the article was published, the man with custody of those separated kids came face to face with Katie Waldman, the Department of Homeland Security spokeswoman, at an Immigration Policy Coordinating Committee meeting. She wanted to know how the New York Times could have gotten a hold of the Office of Refugee Resettlement's list of separated kids. "How is this possible?" Waldman, the pugnacious 27-year-old, asked Lloyd. Leaking was the cardinal sin of the Trump administration, and the president himself would call leakers traitors and cowards the following month. "I'm trying to get to the bottom of this," Lloyd told Waldman. "I didn't ask anybody to create a list. When I get to the bottom of this, I'll let you know." Throughout his tenure, when Lloyd had been asked by staff about family separations, he had been using a version of the carefully crafted White House line that, quote, "there is no family separation policy," echoing Waldman and her colleagues at DHS. Now, with the Times article published based on Lloyd's own data, family separations were undeniable. Caitlin Dickerson's expose and the resulting pressure from Waldman made Lloyd irritated. He was left to stew about the leak over the weekend. If the existence of the list itself took Lloyd by surprise, it shouldn't have. It was the same data set he had discussed with then-acting CBP and ICE heads McAleenan and Homan after Commander Jonathan White flagged an increase in separated children in November 2017. In the attached spreadsheet, details including specific names and A numbers for separation referrals received in September and October may be found, read a November 17, 2017 email from White to McAleenan, which Lloyd also received. Embarrassed, Lloyd knew the leak came from his department, on his watch, under an administration that appointed him to his position. When considering how to handle the fallout from the leak, Lloyd's first thought was a drastic one. Let's get rid of the list. If he followed the idea through, it would destroy the critical linkage between the 700 separated children in his custody and their parents, despite the fact that the list itself was the best hope of reuniting them. Lloyd knew that in order to discard the list, he would have to instruct his staff to do so. Lloyd wanted to hear from them before deciding on a course of action. Once back in the office, he queried staff, "Why are we keeping the list? Can't we just email with DHS on a case-by-case basis? You see the problem this created. How can we prevent another leak?" The answer he would receive, of course, was that the list was the only way separated children would be reunited with their parents. The document, Lloyd was reminded, was kept by ORR's senior federal field specialist, Jim De La Cruz, for explicitly that reason. The problem wasn't the existence of the list, but the separations themselves. "We're the only ones tracking," one ORR official later told me about what was explained to Lloyd. "We can't rely on our colleagues at DHS to give us information after." Lloyd listened. but his apparent bewilderment didn't sit well with some colleagues. It sounds like Scott had no idea what the fuck the Times article was talking about when he had been elevating data about separations through our leadership, one official told me. Not only were we in the field seeing these kids, or our stakeholders were seeing it too. That Tuesday, April 24th, Lloyd would have the opportunity to act on his instinct to get rid of the list. On that day, key Health and Human Services officials would gather for a weekly ORR coordinating meeting in the office of Steve Wagner, the acting assistant secretary of HHS's Administration for Children and Families. In the room, when the topic of the list was raised, an ACF public affairs official, who had the following week been a part of the hurried email exchange in advance of the Times publishing, had a suggestion. He believed that the, quote, half-baked and, quote, casual list would lead to both internal confusion and public affairs crises like the one the Times article caused. So he put forward an option he felt would help avoid the problem in the future. Can we not keep the numbers? He asked. Lloyd, who had already thought of the idea, and Wagner both indicated their support. They turned to Jalen Suolog for her response. Suolog attended this weekly meeting having replaced Jonathan White, acting as the deputy director of ORR since he left in March. She was the person in the room closest to the list itself. Suolog, who has a master's degree in clinical psychology and 20 years of child welfare experience, knew she never could or would let that happen because of the consequences, she later told colleagues. So she said as little as possible to her boss, Lloyd, and his boss, Wagner. Okay, I'll see what I can do, she replied. The meeting ended without Lloyd acting on his earlier impulse to specifically and literally order the destruction of the list. But quickly, word spread throughout the office about what had happened and what those in the meeting understood their director's intention to be. It was insane Lloyd was even surprised this number would come out in the media and pretend he didn't know what the hell it was about, an ORR official told me. Suolog conveyed her feelings about what had happened to De La Cruz, who had been keeping the list since the limited separations occurred at the end of the Obama administration. If Lloyd expected Suolog to instruct De La Cruz to stop keeping the list, she never did. Nor did De La Cruz do anything of the sort. On the contrary, he continued adding to it as the number of separated children rapidly grew. Had the keeping of the list been stopped, any reunification of those 700 children would have been made needlessly more complicated, compounding the pain and trauma suffered as time apart from their parents grew longer. Neither Suolog nor De La Cruz would allow the destruction of the list to happen. But they were powerless to stop the policy itself. April 23, 2018. After you leave Brownsville, Texas, and head east, the Rio Grande seems to inch closer and closer until, at times, you can see it out the window, and you're almost driving next to it. In the final stretch before the river meets the Gulf of Mexico, Highway 4 splits northeast, and the waterway bends south, hugging the Las Palomas Wildlife Management Area on both sides. As the Dateline team and I approached the sand dunes at the end of the highway, I felt we were reaching the end of our story. This was our 18th day of filming. We had only a handful of locations left before we were scheduled to head into the edit booth to put our hour-long primetime special together about realities of life along the border. We carried on, driving, as is allowed, out and onto the sand. Seagulls flew overhead as wind-pushed waves washed up along the shore out my driver's side window, water coming to within 3 or 4 yards of the car. We drove in silence until we hit the spot where the Rio Grande empties into the extra salty water of the Gulf. We were on the border, but there was no wall, and not a single Border Patrol agent. Standing on a sandbar in the middle of the river, halfway between the United States and Mexico, or maybe standing in both countries, were Mexican fishermen with nets attached to the end of their poles. At least five of them were there, fully clothed in waist-high water, as the confluence of the two bodies of water churned around them. On the U.S. side, we were so close I could shout across to people enjoying their Monday afternoon out around the back of a pickup truck. "Hi! Hola!" I projected. "Hola!" a man screamed back. He was selling something, and he decided we were a potential customer. So he grabbed his blue cooler and, without taking off his t-shirt, started swimming through the murky water of the Rio Grande from Mexico into the United States, maybe a 15-yard journey. When he made it, he braced himself on the muddy bank, only his head and shoulders above the waterline. I crouched down as he was opening his cooler, which had also acted something like a flotation device on his swim across. Inside were dried shrimp, along with a giant bottle of hot sauce and limes. When he realized we were filming, the man, a heavy-set guy with a closely cropped haircut, hid his face behind the cooler. "How much?" I asked. $5, he told me. I gave him 20 and told him to keep the change. He gave us extra bags of shrimp. We shook hands, and I thanked him in English. He had clearly done this before. "All right, nice to meet you. Be safe," I shouted as he swam away. "All right," he said back. I wished him well.